today, 2022 is looking good. The DFA Daily to the 16th of August, 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we consider the reality versus the fantasy of COVID herd immunity. We look at pressure on CBA from shareholders to get serious about the environment, the Bank of Queensland's unfair small business contracts, and some new property hotspots or not. And we consider whether retirees will really die with money still in super as the government seeks to encourage them to withdraw more cash. But is this self-interest? First, some sobering news from Bloomberg. As COVID-19 surged last year, governments worldwide touted the hope of herd immunity, a promised land where the virus stopped spreading exponentially because enough people were protected against it. That's now looking like a fantasy. The thinking was that the pandemic would ebb and then mostly fade once a chunk of the population, perhaps 60 to 70%, was vaccinated or had resistance through a previous infection. But new variants like Delta, which are more transmissible and have been shown to evade those protections in some cases, are moving the bar for herd immunity near impossibly high levels. Delta is spurring widening outbreaks in countries like the US and the UK that have already been walloped by the virus and presumably have some measure of natural immunity in addition to vaccination rates of more than 50%. And it's also hitting nations that have until now managed to keep the virus out almost entirely, like Australia and China. This month, the Infectious Diseases Society of America estimated that Delta had pushed the threshold for herd immunity to well over 80% and possibly close to 90%. Public health officials like Anthony Fauci have drawn controversy by shifting the goalposts over the past year, increasing the number of people who need protection before hitting herd immunity. Meanwhile, vaccine hesitancy and supply issues mean most countries won't get close to even the original numbers. Will we get to herd immunity? No, it's very unlikely by definition, said Greg Poland, director of the vaccine research group at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Even a vaccination rate as high as 95% wouldn't achieve it, he said. It is a neck and neck race between the development of ever more highly transmissible variants, which develop the capacity to evade immunity, and immunization rates. Nature isn't going to solve the problem either. It's unclear how long natural immunity gained from surviving COVID-19 will last and whether it will be effective at fighting off new strains. Future variants, including some that will evade immunity even more effectively than Delta, raises questions about how and when this will be over. If it was as simple as getting the infection once means you are immune for life, that would be great. But I don't think that's the case, said S.V. Malhaven, Director of South Asia Outreach at the Centre for Asian Health Research and Education at Stanford University Medical Centre. That's a troubling problem. Already, there are signs that some people in some places like Brazil and other countries in South America are being battered a second time by newer strains. Without herd immunity, the virus could linger for decades in some form, possibly forcing the world's most powerful nations to adjust their diverging strategies on opening borders and economies. Countries like China have pursued tight so-called COVID zero policies by attempting to wipe out every infection. May eventually have to consider a looser stance. Others like the US and the UK have opened up despite a resurgence of the virus and run the risk of wave after wave of infection. Vaccines so far haven't been the quick fix that some had hoped for. Israel, among the most vaccinated countries in the world, has already started administering booster shots amid evidence that the current immunizations aren't offering the protections that were hoped. Last week, the US said Americans with weakened immune systems will get a third dose. The most powerful vaccines, including the mRNA shots from Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna, would make it easier to reach high levels of immunity since they are so effective. Yet, breakthrough infections, cases in the immunised, are possible with even those shots. Other vaccines, including those made by China's developers, AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, may offer even less protection. Herd immunity, though, is a real thing, protecting much of the world against viral threats, from the measles to polio, and scientists credit it for helping eradicate smallpox. Having herd immunity as a goal likely helped the world embrace measures like wearing masks and social distancing, but it also created a false narrative. The focus on herd immunity has, in my view, been quite damaging, said William Hanage, an epidemiologist and expert in communicable disease dynamics at Harvard Chen School of Public Health. It presents people with an unrealistic vision of how the pandemic comes to a close and doesn't account for the evolution of either the virus or the nature of disease in reinfections. Some countries learn the shortfalls of herd immunity the hard way. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson originally planned to use it as the primary approach to COVID-19, suggesting some of his constituents would take it on the chin with natural infections before the magnitude of the coronavirus force became apparent. Others are now throwing in the towel, with Indonesia most vocally leading the way, the world's fourth most populous nation, determined that it would be impossible to stop the virus even if everyone in the country was immunised. So it's redoubling its efforts to promote mask wearing and social distancing while continuing to boost the still low vaccination rate. And meanwhile, Singapore and Australia are easing cautiously toward reopening, promising they will do so as they hit sufficiently high vaccination levels. Despite evidence that it will be difficult or impossible to reach herd immunity, many public health officials aren't willing to give up on it. Governments worldwide are focusing on widening inoculation programs, yet the individualistic approach of many countries and vaccine shortages are contributing to the global problem. The risk of the virus remains for everyone as long as any nation is experiencing massive outbreaks. The world is unlikely to put the pandemic behind it until 2022 at the earliest, experts say, and that target could be pushed back if the virus mounts another metamorphosis to become even more transmissible or even better at evading resistance. There is hope for new vaccines and other approaches that could stop transmission more dramatically, but none of those are in human trials yet, and it will be a few years before they are a real possibility. Instead, the virus has a high likelihood of remaining entrenched globally, causing outbreaks that are hopefully mitigated partly by vaccinations, masking, and other public health-driven interventions. Delta is not something we'll be able to eradicate, Hanage said. Even Alpha would have been hard. However, with sufficient immunity, ideally achieved by vaccination, we can expect it to become a much milder illness. The Spanish flu of 1918 shows how COVID may play out, the Mayo Clinic's Poland said. It's likely the variants will continue to emerge, forcing the use of boosters or routine immunizations targeted to the newer strains. Then, if we are lucky, what is likely to happen is that this will become something more akin to influenza, where we will always have it, Poland said. It'll become more seasonal, just like the coronaviruses that are already circulating, and we will just have to keep immunising. Now, back here in Australia, the Federal Court has made orders requiring Commonwealth Bank of Australia to publish notices on its website and its newsroom acknowledging the bank's false, almost leading conduct when it overcharged interest on business overdraft accounts. The notices, referred to as adverse publicity orders, requires CBA to publish at its own expense both a written and audiovisual notice on CBA's website and in its newsroom, and to ensure that each notice appears immediately upon access to the landing page as a picture title on the website under the heading Notification of Misconduct by CBA, and is maintained on the website for 90 days. The requirement for CBA to notify its customers and the general public that it unlawfully overcharged interest is an important part of deterrence, along with the $7 million fine handed down by the court. Not only does it ensure that CBA's customers and the general public are aware of the misconduct, it sends a strong message that there is significant financial and reputational risk for failing to have the systems in place to prevent overcharging, said Asset Commissioner Sean Hughes. CBA breached the law on 12,119 occasions when it charged higher than advised interest rates on business overdraft accounts. As a result of ASIC's proceedings, CBA was ordered by the court to pay $7 million in a penalty for the misconduct, and CBA has been ordered to provide a proposed version of the audiovisual notice to the court by the 27th of August 2021. By way of background, on the 30th of November 2020, ASIC commenced proceedings against CBA for overcharging interest on business overdraft accounts. The total overcharge interest exceeded $2.2 million, and CBA's conduct in this matter resulted from inadequate systems and processes. CBA admitted to ASIC's allegations. And CBA's conduct was the subject of a case study by the Royal Commission into Misconduct in the banking, superannuation and financial services industry. CBA has remediated $3.74 million to the customers impacted in this case. And elsewhere, more than 100 shareholders will bring forward a resolution at CBA's forthcoming AGM to force it to improve its commitments towards net zero emissions by 2050 after it was accused of watering down fossil fuel divestment plans in its annual report. The resolution, which calls on CBA to no longer fund expansion of the fossil fuel industry and set targets to reduce industry exposure consistent with net zero by 2050, is likely to receive strong shareholder support, with similar resolutions against ANZ and NAB receiving 28.7 and 26.3% shares of votes, respectively, the bank's AGMs. Despite committing to the climate goals of the Paris Agreement and achieving net zero emissions by 2050, CBA is aligning its investment practices and policies with the failures of these goals, resulting in our company falling behind rapidly evolving investor and regulatory expectations and the practice of other financial institutions, the supporting statement to the resolution read. CBA continues to finance companies and projects that expand the scale of the fossil fuel industry. This is contrary to its commitment to the Paris Agreement and net zero emissions by 2050 and the bank's own policy. Analysis from shareholder activist group Market Forces revealed that the bank's climate disclosures set out in its latest annual report are based on the International Environment Agency's Sustainable Development Scenario that aims towards net zero emissions by 2070, rather than the more ambitious Paris target of net zero by 2050. The group also pointed to the bank having watered down its commitment to only funding new oil, gas, and metallurgical coal projects that were consistent with the Paris Agreement, as this commitment now only applied to project finance, rather than all banking and financing activity in its report. If the IPCC's report was a kick in the teeth to all those who desperately want a safe climate future, CommBank's new climate policy is a kick in the guts to follow it up, Market Forces Australian Campaigns Coordinator Jack Bertolos said. What CBA has delivered is a retreat from its existing policy and makes a mockery of its own claim to be supportive of net zero by 2050. We're living in a moment where we need to pull out all the stops to prevent catastrophic climate change, yet the first thing CBA does is to aim for failure. The group pointed to a range of CBA's current clients that were inconsistent with a commitment towards the Paris targets, including the bank's co-financing of Santos Timor Seagas Field, which mining magnate Andrew Forrest has called one of the most polluting projects in the world, and its vague expectations of transition plans from Santos and Origin Energy by 2025, with no consequences if these are not produced. CBA is giving some of Australia's biggest polluters and climate laggards a four-year amnesty from taking action. At least there should be no confusion now about why shareholders are so keen to take them to task, Mr. Bertolus said. And elsewhere, the federal court has declared that several terms within some of Bank of Queensland's small business contracts were unfair. In a statement released on Friday, ASIC confirmed that the unfair terms were found in standard form loan contracts between Bank of Queensland and its small business customers from the 12th of November 2016. The court found that the terms included unilateral variation clauses that allowed Bank of Queensland to vary the terms and conditions of their contracts without giving borrowers advance notice or an opportunity to exit the contract without penalty. Event of default clauses that allowed Bank of Queensland to unilaterally determine whether a default had occurred. Indemnification clauses that allowed Bank of Queensland to make a claim against a customer for losses caused by Bank of Queensland mistake. And error or negligence and conclusive evidence clauses that meant that if the Bank of Queensland issued a certificate stating an amount owing by a customer, that amount would be assumed to be correct unless the customer could prove otherwise. Small business owners deserve to be able to enter into fair loan contracts, especially where they have little or no ability to negotiate the terms, ASIC Commissioner Sean Hughes said. ASIC will take action against unfair practices in standard form contracts, whether it be for consumers or for small business. The court has ordered that the terms be replaced with new fair terms agreed by all parties, and the declarations sought are appropriate because they serve to record the court's disapproval of the contravening conduct, vindicate the claim by ASIC that the bank contravened the Act, assist ASIC to carry out the duties conferred upon it by the Act, and to deter other corporations from entering into contracts containing unfair terms, Justice Banks Smith said. Well, this timing is pretty unfortunate, given that the Bank of Queensland also has just called for an array of regulatory reforms in order to equalise smaller banks against the majors and to improve credit access. In response to questions on notice from the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics, the Bank of Queensland has suggested a slew of regulatory changes in the interest of boosting the competitive powers of smaller and regional banks against the major players. The answers have followed the appearance of Bank of Queensland Chief Executive George Frazis before the committee in July, when he argued for certain changes to help smaller banks, including allowing digital signatures, blocking mergers for the Big Four, and easing requirements for fintechs. In its newly published written response to the committee, Bank of Queensland stated that a more level playing field between the major banks and their rivals would allow for smaller banks to provide Australians with cheaper, quicker access to credit, aiding Australia's recovery from the COVID crisis. The government should also allow lenience for small banks to implement reforms, Bank of Queensland said, stating that its non-major peers often struggle to keep up with the fast pace of regulatory change. The government's plans to scrap responsible lending laws was outlined as a positive first step for boosting small banks. According to Bank of Queensland, the proposed reforms would streamline the loan application process and collection of customer information and simplify the framework by no longer requiring banks to deal with multiple regulators on the issue. Instead, APRA would be the sole watchdog. Bank of Queensland views the reforms as a means of ensuring the efficient flow of credit to assist the economy from the effects of COVID-19, the document stated. And Mr. Frazis had previously argued the reforms would simplify the lending processes for retail and small business customers. And Bank of Queensland also suggested a number of other reforms, which it also stated would assist with the digitalisation of Australia's economy. The recommended changes were allowing banks to access customer data with the Australian Taxation Office with customer consent to verify a loan applicant's income, the introduction of legislation to support electronic signing of documents and the hosting of virtual annual general meetings by corporations, the digital delivery of documents under the National Consumer Credit Code, and the removal of obligations for banks to publish changes to product terms and conditions in newspapers, and the phasing out of cheques as a payment method. The government passed legislation last week extending the relief which allows digital signatures to be used on documents until the 31st of March 2022, and it also signalled plans to introduce permanent reforms later in the year. similar to the Bank of Queensland, Beyond Bank, explained the impact of digital signatures in a recent published written response to the committee, stating the use of e-signatures on mortgage documents would reduce the processing time by up to 9 days. This would improve the customer experience through reduced processing time, and therefore the bank would be very supportive of the implementation of e-signatures on documents, Beyond Bank wrote. Australian Banking Association CEO Anna Bligh previously told the committee that in-person signing could add days to an approval process, and it was a tool that no one needed or wanted. Among the regulatory burdens, Bank of Queensland listed risk weight assets and covered bonds as further hurdles. Looking at covered bonds, Bank of Queensland stated that increasing the amount of funding banks could access from 8% to 15% of their Australian assets would allow non-major players to raise funds at a lower cost. And it stated the change would reduce average funding costs across banks, the entire wholesale funding base, by roughly 4 basis points, and it would provide a more reliable source of funding. By increasing the covered bond cap for smaller banks, Bank of Queensland would be on a more level playing field with the major banks by neutralising some of the funding cost benefits that they receive due to the implicit government guarantee, and we could offer more competitive pricing to our customers, the bank stated. The government would need to amend the Banking Amendment Covered Bonds Act of 2011 to implement a cap increase. According to the Bank of Queensland, it understands APRA is not opposed to the proposed reform. And Bank of Queensland also flagged that it has engaged with the prudential regulator on risk-weighted assets, discussing the amount of capital that is required to hold for lending on its books. And now to property. A report has attempted to predict the best suburbs to buy property in Australia, with some unexpected results. The Well Home Loans Green Shoots report has identified the top 20 suburbs in Australia that are likely to see prices go up in the next few years, using a methodology that seeks to isolate those that are on the cusp of accelerating growth. Some of the names might be well known to property investors, such as Glenelg in Adelaide and Wynnum in Brisbane, where many are predicting prices to grow ahead of the 2032 Brisbane Olympics. But others, such as Mount Johns in Alice Springs and Savile Grove on the edge of Perth, might not jump out to investors. Scott Spencer, CEO of Well Home Loans, said that it was the methodology that made the difference. The key indicators that it looked at are inventory levels, so how the levels of supply and demand are on the market, he explained. It looks at the number of days that properties are on the market, which can help understand how popular areas have been. And it also looks at median asking prices and takes that into account. Each of those major indicators gives a different viewpoint. While these are the places that may yet spike, it is important to note that the market is hard to predict because of the pandemic-induced uncertainty. What they're trying to factor in as well is sustainability and trying to isolate whether something is an anomaly, said Spencer. The way that people are moving at the moment has really accelerated from I'd like to live somewhere close to where I work to I'd like to live where I want to be. The report tries to work out whether the data is an anomaly, a COVID-related thing, and will it slow down whenever we get to a post-COVID normal. For us, we haven't been back in the office since March last year, and a couple of our staff have moved to where they've always wanted to be and made sure that they added an extra bedroom so that they could have an office. It certainly provides food for thought for those looking to buy an investment property, as discerning the suburbs with likely property price rises is usually informed by what has already happened rather than what could happen in the future. For us, these are suburbs that don't traditionally come up in the news very often, said Spencer. That's one of the good things about the report. It takes a different set of indicators than most of the larger places. It looks forward rather than looking backwards. You'll see most reports look at what has happened in the last X period of time, whereas this is trying to look at what might potentially happen in the future. Looking at all the different areas across Australia, I don't think many will be the popular suburbs that most people would think about. And finally, super industry bodies have questioned claims made in the government's retirement income paper that a large proportion of retirees will die with money still in super, saying it's self-interested to encourage them to withdraw more cash. As part of the retirement income covenant starting from the 1st of July 2022, the government is seeking to further develop the retirement outcomes in Australia's superannuation framework and address the findings or the Retirement Income Review. Drawing on research released during the Retirement Income Review, the Morrison government's Retirement Income Covenant paper highlighted that $1 in every $3 in the super system will be passed down to the next generation by 2060. This raises the question as to whether the answer to lifting the retirement incomes of Australians is more superannuation savings or better guidance about how to maximise their superannuation savings during their retirement, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg previously said. As such, the paper argues that retirees should be encouraged to spend their superannuation instead of handing down a large proportion of their nest egg to their families. However, the Industry Super Association has come out swinging, questioning the government's maths and arguing that most retirees outlive their super. Using HILDA data, the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia survey, it showed that 80% of people aged 60 and over and 90% of people aged 80 and over who died in the period 2014 to 18 had no super at all in the period of up to 4 years before death, the ISA said in its submission to the government, dispelling the government's concerns about older Australians building up large super balances. The group stated that of those currently aged 80 and above, only 5% had a balance of $110,000 or more in their superannuation balances. In a separate submission, the AFSA drew attention to data from the Australian Tax Office, which revealed that around 1.7 million Australians aged 70 and over have no superannuation, or in other words, over 60% of those aged 70 and over have no super. In a nutshell, the government believes retirees have too much super, while the industry fund claims they don't have enough. Adding to the debate, Super Consumers Australia believe current retirement targets are out of reach for the typical Aussies, leaving them disengaged with their super. As such, Director Xavier O'Halloran has urged the government to acknowledge the different retirement strategies Australians need. According to Super Consumers, Australians fell into one of three distinct cohorts of retirement thinkers: engaged delegates at 25%, engaged DIY at 37%, and the disengaged at 38%, with each group said to be practicing a different approach to their retirement. Mr. O'Halloran concluded that Aussies need more specific support. We do a lot more to support people during their working lives to find the best products for their super, with quality filters and comparable independent guidance about the quality of products. We need to give the same assistance to people planning for retirement, he added. The ISA agreed, highlighting the importance of strong financial default products for members with lower engagement. It has long been ISA's position that in a compulsory superannuation system with poor financial literacy, most members should be able to rely on default settings that protect their interests without recourse to personal advice, they stated. According to Super Consumers Australia's submission, self-interested voices are driving the debate instead of focusing on what is best for retirees. At the moment, we're seeing people switch off due to fear when confronted by unrealistic and frankly unnecessary retirement savings targets, Mr. O'Halloran said. There are some self-interested voices in this debate, quoting the need for $1 million in savings. It makes an attractive headline, but this isn't what the majority of Australians who are just looking to maintain their standards of living in retirement need to hear. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot
Ruben an email at info@rubenproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer.
I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.